Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be speaking with Muzamil Hussein, who is the co-author with Philip Howard, of the new book, Democracy's Fourth Wave, Digital Media, and the Arab Spring. I hope you enjoy the interview. Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown, and I'm have the real pleasure to speak today with Muzamil Hussein. Muzamil, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's very nice to speak to you, Heath. I'm calling in from Seattle right now, so it's about afternoon here, so nice to be chatting with you.
Okay, yeah, it's a real pleasure. Pleasure to have read the book, which I look forward to talking to you about, because I think it's incredibly timely, and that's actually one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about. But before we get to this, maybe you can introduce yourself a little bit, where you are. We know you're physically right now in Seattle, but where you are institutionally, where you've been institutionally, and just a little bit about yourself.
Oh, well, let's see. I am currently finishing up here at the University of Washington in Seattle. I'm part of the doctoral program in communication, the Department of Communication. But originally, you know, the work that we'll be chatting about today as well, that started many years ago while I was at the other UW, the University of Wisconsin at Madison. So for maybe 7 or 8 years now, I've been very much kind of interested and involved in research on digital media and politics. So I started working on that topic immediately when I moved back here about 5 years ago. So that's what I work on, is digital media and politics. And I'm actually kind of institutionally moving soon as well. I'm starting up at the University of Michigan Ann Arbor as an assistant prof at the Department of Communication Studies there. I also have a joint appointment in the Center for Political Studies, which is part of the ISR, the Institute for Social Research. So kind of in between spaces, but, it's been an exciting and interesting time for me.
Yeah, well, congratulations. That is wonderful news. You didn't write this book alone. So how did you and Phil Howard come to work together on this book? He is your co-author. So what is the collaboration the basis of?
Sure. Phil Howard is actually one of my closest advisors here in Madison, and we've been working together for well over 5 years now. And this work, this book we're speaking about today, actually is an outcome of a multi-year project that is housed in the NSF-funded project on information technology and political Islam. So the project is broader, focusing on more than just the Arab Middle East or North African countries. And since 2009, we've been working on several reports and publications and analyses about the different ways in which digital media has meshed with civil society in a host of developing countries that exist on a spectrum of democratization and authoritarianism. So the work for this book actually draws on sort of 3 to 4 years of work that had been happening since before the Arab Spring.
Great. It seems in my reading of the book that one of your objectives is to seek out some middle ground between sort of the parties that give credit for just about everything connected to the Arab Spring to Twitter, and on the other side, those that discount social media as essentially irrelevant. So when you began this book, what did you make of the commentary about social media, this sort of larger, often not scholarly conversation, but there was a lot of conversation that was going on out there. How would you characterize these major sort of public discussions of the topic of the book?
Sure. Well, the public discussion actually, you know, traces its history even to local politics here in the U.S. And ever since digital media started to mesh with U.S. electoral politics, we've had this sometimes heated but necessary discussion about, you know, what are the consequences of increased uses of new media platforms. So in that sense, you know, I've seen a direct parallel, you know, in discussing these issues internationally as well, is the discussion seems to divide in sort of two diametric avenues, one really focusing on the empowering aspects of digital media, and on the other hand, the very sophisticated and threatening ways in which state powers also come down and try to control these new platforms and services that are critically necessary and important. So we've engaged with that even at the scholarly level, tried to analyze or at least portray the both optimistic as well as the pessimistic perspective. And one of the outcomes that we hope that comes out of the book is to point at the fact that both of them do have, you know, legitimate kind of observations based in experiences of users in very diverse spaces, but there may be angles that are being missed in that heated diametric debate. And part of that is the story about the meshing of digital media with mass media as well. And so, you know, in one of our chapters on Al Jazeera and civic journalism, we talk about the third space that is might be a little bit overlooked between the pessimistic and optimistic perspectives.
The one of the ways that you do this, and you sort of cut through some of the sort of political conversations about this, is sort of the empirical focus of your work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of political scientists that are very interested in incorporating digital media or new media into their research, but they don't quite know how to do it. So how did you do it? What are the major sources of data that you looked at? You mentioned that this is built into a larger project, and so as someone who's based, who does political work, but you have this home in communications, what are the data sources that you look at? How did you collect up the information that you then went about analyzing in such an interesting way?
Sure. So the data for the book actually comes from many different sources, and the way the data is structured that we work through also depends on the kind of questions we're asking. So, for example, in our chapter focusing on how civic actors use digital media, we drew on the narratives that were themselves documented on digital spaces. So when the Arab Spring was happening, we were actively collecting and curating narratives, interview data, and also collecting our own sort of social media analytics information on what was happening and archived at the back end. So we were looking at that from the civic angle for the chapters on how authoritarian regimes or the regimes in general have approached these environments. That comes from going through media archives, news archives, as well as technical sort of hacker logs about sort of back-end events that hackers themselves have taken note of in identifying networks that were interfered with. So the authoritarian chapter, the chapter on authoritarian regimes interventions with digital media comes from a 15-year period in which we documented about close to 500 cases where both democracies and authoritarian governments have interfered with digital media networks in many different ways. So for each chapter, the data depends on the questions we're looking at. So we draw on many different types of data sets.
One of I think the nice aspects of this book is you don't sort of plop yourself right down on day one and sort of look ahead. You make this argument that there were these pre-existing levels of access to media, familiarity with media that existed in some of the countries that you studied. May exist at different levels for different parts of each society.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if you, for maybe just one of the countries that you studied, you could characterize the pre-Arab Spring digital conversation, where it was taking place. Was it political?
Mm-hmm.
It certainly wasn't as revolutionary as we see it during the time period that you focus on.
Mm-hmm.
But what was the digital environment just before the focus of the book, which is the Arab Spring?
So, there are probably four big points that we can summarize from the period immediately before, not immediately before, but about 5 to 6 years before the Arab Spring really took root. We noticed that in many different countries, there were four big things happening. Number one was the fact that even in some of the most repressive political environments, there was an increased level of international news content that was accessible and was being read actively by citizens in those environments. So things like BBC news articles and CNN coverage would be accessible online, even though state media and broadcast media were easier to control and censor in places like Egypt. Number two, we also saw a rising level of networking applications being used by individual citizens. Now, this is important because these types of technologies allow people to control their social network and communicate with their social network in different ways depending on what they were trying to achieve. Number three, we saw civil society organizations themselves moving online. In one of our chapters, we've actually we got pretty lucky in the sense that we completed a digital map of political parties in Egypt that existed online and sort of what their connections were. And then so we did a follow-up map about 6 months after to see how the structure of the Egyptian political party online communication patterns had changed. And number four, we were also noticing that these spaces allowed for previously marginalized groups, feminist movements, youth movements, who were, you know, had to be a lot more careful operating in offline environments, were doing so online, making use of online spaces to communicate, find each other, and find shared grievances, and sometimes even mobilize long-term strategies for how they should do their work. So those four big points were happening for at least 5 or 6 years before the spring really took off.
But then there were these dramatic things that happened, mm-hmm. and a couple of things happened in a couple of different countries, but it was in many ways the unique characteristics of social media that took those events and did something very different than what would have happened to them 20 years before or without the existence of certain social media mm-hmm. Devices. What were those events? And what was there? Why did social media change the way in which those events were consumed more broadly?
Generally, you know, I think it's an issue of speed. I mean, we, you know, revolutions have happened historically long before digital media was ever part of the narrative. But speed and access really changed in this round of events. And we can talk in a little bit more detail about, you know, how this happened. So in the book, we outline sort of maybe six big points about what happened during the immediate period of mobilizing around the spring. And that was number one, there was a preparation phase which involved activists using digital media over time to build solidarity networks. And that was in place already. But in major cases like Tunisia and Egypt, there was always an ignition phase, something that was symbolically powerful, like the case where Mohamed Bouazizi self-immolated himself. And these symbolic moments, you know, were shared over digital media long before state media even tried to cover these events. This fed into a third kind of protest phase where both offline networks and digital technologies were used together by small groups to strategically organize large numbers of people to show up. That moved into an international buy-in phase where broadcast networks and international coverage came into play, where these local moments went international. So the world was paying attention very quickly. The last two phases that we've outlined covered the climax phase where then regimes and state powers came into play to recognize that, oh, look, something really important is happening. We haven't address these things in a way to censor or to address it as a public moment. So various regimes use different measures, either using welfare packages or repressive techniques to try to control coverage and mobilization. And finally, you know, after that period ended, there would always be a follow-on sort of information warfare phase where both state-based actors and international solidarity networks started to compete over the digital environments themselves, addressing the fact that these digital networks and spaces were important and are an important place where politics were being exercised. So, and now we see a very active discussion internationally about the regulations behind digital spaces and access.
One of the things the section on the response of the authoritarian regimes mm-hmm. I thought was really interesting. I want to talk about that, but I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, the extent to which what you write about is generalizable outside of the cases that you look at. You talk a little bit about this, but you know, you suggest that this kind of digital activism happens in a series of stages. Mm-hmm. How applicable is this to other parts of the world, other countries in the region, other technologies? Mm-hmm. I know that wasn't one of your purposes of writing the book, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how universal these stages in this model is.
So general razzability is something we've tried to take very seriously in the way we've argued and elicited different observations to support these claims. And so in our takeaway points about generalizability, we limit our generalizations at this moment to the 20-plus cases in Middle East and North Africa. And so, you know, we're not interested in generating a theory of democratization around particular tool like Facebook or Twitter. But we are interested in understanding how these technologies are, you know, socially constructed by the users, as well as governments who have a lot more power in defining the macro environment in which these tools are deployed. So right now, you know, in our observations of the Arab Spring, we talk about the actual events that took place. And so we use, rather than using only a qualitative or case study approach, or on the other hand, trying to generalize to the, you know, close to 200 countries that that exist today, we focus on these 20 or so cases to limit our generalizations. And so, you know, speaking of how governments have exercised control on digital spaces in those countries, we know that sort of four general ways. So, number one, some regimes, you know, particularly in Egypt, for example, exercise full network shutdown. So when during sensitive moments like elections or crisis moments, rather than trying to control parts of digital media environments, they just pull the entire plug in and disable vast portions of society from being online. But there's also, you know, many other smaller ways in which they do that as well. So shutting down specific sites, like blocking access to the entire Twitter network as opposed to all digital media. Or going offline to target individuals, so beating up bloggers or arresting folks is a less technically savvy but also powerful way to coerce citizens. Well, the one that I'm most interested in these days is the proxy methods of control, so going after internet service providers. So in Egypt, for example, we saw the Mubarak regime trying to coerce corporations based outside of the country itself, going after Vodafone in London or other internet service providers like that to become part of the control apparatus. So these proxy methods are pretty complicated, but I think very important to continue expanding that.
One of the very interesting, I forgot where it was exactly in the book, but there is this point at which the regimes who appear to have been caught in digital terms behind the curve in terms of their sophistication. Mm-hmm. And one of the steps they take is to try to shut down networks, mm-hmm. which results in people turning out in the street because they don't have the information that they've been getting digitally, mm-hmm. which it seems then accelerates not the digital component of this, but the political change aspect of mm-hmm. this. I wonder if you could walk through what those steps were that the different regimes took in response. You sort of highlight these different categories, but maybe there are a couple of anecdotes or particular ones that stick out to you, and one of these regimes that really, I don't know, bungled isn't quite the right way to think about it, but whose approach showed that they really didn't understand the medium. Mm-hmm. They didn't understand technology, and as a result, exactly what they didn't want to happen did happen, even if it was quite a positive thing in terms of democracy or representation.
Sure. You know, I think to maybe illustrate that point a little bit more, I would say let's compare how Saudi Arabia and Egypt have approached their digital control strategies differently. In Saudi Arabia, you know, basing off of the kind of long-term importance that the regime has given to building a digital infrastructure, most of all internet traffic, as far as we know, goes through Riyadh in a centrally organized set of servers that control all of the traffic and monitor the content that's being shared over the entire internet. On the other hand, in Egypt, for a long time, we observed, you know, commentaries of the state itself saying, you know, maybe it's good to have some of these online spaces so people can go and vent. And so they didn't really take a very active role in having a sophisticated management approach. So, and in fact, Fed part of the access that civic actors use for democratically oriented music. So if we put a magnifying glass on Egypt, for example, during the Arab Spring, we saw a couple of things that happened that the regime may not have seen the direct outcome of. So when the regime, for example, turned off the access to the entire internet, users went to their previously existing social institutions to find each other. So when people couldn't communicate on mobile phones or find each other online, they showed up at Friday prayers. You know, Egypt is a Muslim society, and people have a habit of going to Friday prayers in large numbers. So these religious institutions and habits ended up being mobilization tools as well. So people went to actual physical environments to find each other, and so the actual turnout on the street increased to probably peak even when the regime turned off access to digital and mobile networks.
Just so much that we can learn about this political phenomena that is certainly still underway in some ways, but also about technology and digital media that is applicable, even if some of the specific lessons about activism aren't, we can't universalize, certainly can learn a lot about how this works. What's next for you? What is your next project? You have a new book project that you're working on. Are you staying in this realm, or are you moving into another area of research? What can we expect from you in the next period of time?
Myself in particular, I'm still very much fascinated with this area of work on, you know, comparative international politics and digital politics. So I'm interested in working at that intersection. And so I can actually tell you a little bit about sort of what I've been up to the past year. So I've actually just come back to Seattle. I've only been back for maybe 10 or 11 weeks. So all of last year I was doing field work in the Middle East, North Africa, and also Western Europe. And I've been paying attention to how Western democracies, a lot of them who have, you know, highly advanced industrial economies that produce many of the tools that are bought by developing countries, including Egypt and Tunisia, how these tools are being used in unintended ways that the technology producers themselves have created. So we know, for example, that censorship tools used here to block child pornography and things like that are being used to do political censorship abroad. So there's an active discussion now in the aftermath of the Arab Spring to understand how to regulate or keep the producers in check and responsible for how those tools are used abroad. So that's probably the third space beyond authoritarian control and civic uses. I'm interested in the regulatory environment online to manage these relationships.
Well, when that project finishes, I hope that you will come back and talk about the book project that results from that. Until then, Democracy's Fourth Wave, Digital Media, and the Arab Spring, as recently published by Oxford in their Digital Politics series. You can get that at the Oxford University Press website or on Amazon. Muzamil, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much. It was nice speaking with you.